Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Douthwaite, who is one of the curators of the John Le Carré exhibition at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Now, for those watching on YouTube, we have some exclusive footage that I took from the exhibition. If you're listening on audio, now might be a time to switch to YouTube. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Dr. Jessica Douthwaite, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. And so you are the main curator of this wonderful John Le Carré exhibition called Tradecraft. Before we kind of go into it, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so I'm a historian by background and training, a Cold War specialist, but broadly my history focuses on Britain in the 20th century and social and cultural history. But previously to this, I've worked in partnership with some national museums working on Cold War exhibitions like National Museums of Scotland.
Brilliant. We're here today to talk about John Le Carré Tradecraft. So I was wondering if you can give us just a quick overview of what it is, when it's on, and how long it will run for.
Great. Right. So John Le Carré Tradecraft is on now, and it will run until the 6th of April 2025. It's at Bodleian Libraries in Oxford. So the Bodleian Libraries now houses the full John Le Carré archive of his literary drafts, manuscripts, his correspondence, photography, and many other bits and pieces. It's a huge archive, and the Bodleian has been in the process of acquisitioning it since 2010, and it's now available to researchers. So what we have in the exhibition is a kind of first dip into that archive. Of material that's never been on public display before. And the premise of the exhibition is to look at Le Carré as a researcher writer. So someone who put an enormous amount of effort into the research of the context, the characters, the places, locations of his novels before he even began to write them. And my colleague, Federico Varese, who is professor of criminology at Nuffield College, Oxford, was a friend, but also someone who collaborated with Le Carré on a couple of his novels. And Federico came to the Bodleian with this idea when the archives were kind of being catalogued. And so first and foremost, we wanted to position Le Carré as a researcher writer. We wanted to look at his method and the process behind writing his novels. And we also wanted to look at him beyond his spy writing. So although many people will perhaps know him best for his kind of spy fiction and Cold War espionage, we wanted to bring, half of his writing career was spent outside of the Cold War. So we wanted to look at his post-Cold War fiction in equal amounts, and also to view him as someone who wrote about the world and not just spying in Europe. So we cover a geographical breadth. Kind of that was quite a crucial theme throughout the exhibition.
Yeah, well, there's so much to draw from because you've got like 1,200 boxes spanning his entire career. So how did you approach curating such a vast collection?
We began with these three central premises. We had a kind of structure already in place, but we knew that we wanted to delve first into a couple of novels. So we chose nine novels that we hope would span the breadth of the themes. And then, so we have 9 novels ranging from kind of a perfect spy and Tinker Tailor Soldier spy all the way through to A Most Wanted Man, which is kind of viewed as his post 9/11 novel, and The Mission Song. So you get a bit of chronological and geographical breadth through the 9 novels that we've chosen. And then we also pick up on the themes within those novels throughout the rest of the exhibition, focusing mainly on the networks of collaborators and influencers and experts who he drew on in the research for those novels. So people like Federico, for instance, who gave kind of specialist knowledge and information to Le Carré when he was drafting Our Kind of Traitor and our Game.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
With so much material, what in the end couldn't be included? Because I remember we spoke a bit about horticulture and botany when we met.
Yes. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, because it's such a huge archive, and we don't even include all the novels that we would have liked to include. Mm. So there's rather a lot that we could have made more of. One of them is his horticultural research. Now, I haven't been able to view all the archives. I haven't seen all 1,000, I think it's 237 boxes. Mm. But I did find evidence of some very specialised research into the flora and fauna of Panama and the Caribbean for when he was researching The Night Manager. He was very, very, very meticulous about the details contained in his novels for location and people. So he'd obviously visited Panama and visited some of the locations in the novel, and he'd drafted some chapters that he then sent to a horticultural specialist for her take on what he'd included. And she then wrote back with some very detailed information about, you know, whether a flower would bloom at night or during the daytime, right down to that kind of detail. And for a while, we toyed with the idea of including some of these botanical examples to illustrate how kind of committed he was to accuracy, because Federico has an anecdote about Le Carré being very conscious of the types of trees that were growing around a cemetery in Moscow when he was writing Our Kind of Traitor. And I also know that in The Constant Gardener, of course, flowers and plants are a really key motif throughout that novel. So for a while, we toyed with that idea. And I think visually, it would have been very beautiful, but it would have meant doing a lot more research looking for those botanical kind of details. And we didn't have time in the end. So that would be genuinely something I'd love to do.
And was Justin Quayle then Le Carré's sort of expression of this sort of inner horticulturalist that he was?
Well, I think Justin Quayle's character really suited that methodical, sort of very introverted gardener, someone who reverts to his plants as a source of sort of comfort. And I get the sense from Justin Quayle's character that he'd prefer to spend more time with his plants and less time with the people around him. So I think for Le Carré, that was sort of the perfect coupling. And I think also with the colonial context of Kenya in the novel, the way that Justin's kind of English flowers intermingle with the kind of colonial plants of his garden in Kenya is quite an interesting way of dealing with the English abroad. So I think that was a device, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Such a good book, that one. And I think I mentioned to you, I was very lucky to meet John Le Carré once at a protest against George Bush in 2004. Yeah. And when I saw him, I was like, oh my goodness, it's John Le Carré. And just very quickly, I was going to say something. I said, I said to him, I love The Constant Gardener. It's like my favourite book of yours. And he said, God bless you. So whether he was miffed by me pointing out that book in particular or not, I don't know.
But I don't. Sure, he's just very pleased to meet a fan.
Yes,
amazing that you met him on a protest. I would have. I think that's obviously I never met him. Federico knew him very well, but I think that's a place I would have really liked to meet him on a march. You know, we do actually. I mean, speaking of things that we didn't include, we actually have So I'm sure there's quite a lot of fan mail in the archive, which we didn't, because the exhibition is about his research methods, we didn't use much fan mail at all. But we have a letter from George Bush Sr., who has just, in the letter, he's just read The Night Manager, and he's congratulating Le Carré on The Night Manager, saying how much he enjoyed reading it. And I think he finishes it with, from an ex-CIA, ex-prez, or something like that. But my favourite thing about it is that, obviously, John le Carré was a pseudonym, but George Bush Sr. clearly didn't know that. And he addresses it, Dear John, which hardly anyone wrote to him, you know, saying Dear John. So that, but we didn't include it in the end.
No, that's a good one. That's a good one. So what books were and manuscripts were selected for display? And so what was the reasoning behind their selection?
Yeah, so A Perfect Spy, we had to have that in because it's his most autobiographical novel.
Yeah.
We have a really generous and large loan of personal ephemera from the family. And of course, we needed, although this is more about John le Carré, the writer, we needed to talk about his private life to an extent and his childhood, which was very, very influential on his later career in the spy service and his later career as a writer. So A Perfect Spy is semi-autobiographical. It brings into the novel the character of his father, Ronnie Cornwall, who in real life was a kind of con artist, criminal, bit potentially a bit of a gangster, who dabbled in all sorts of kind of crime. So we have A Perfect Spy. We have Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, because we could not leave that out.
No, it's the classic, isn't it? Yeah.
It's the classic. You know, we're very aware that some visitors to this exhibition will be super fans, but some visitors to the exhibition will may not know Le Carré outside of adaptations. So we wanted to make sure that it was accessible to anyone, really. Then we have The Honourable Schoolboy, and I chose that because it's still very much a Cold War novel, but it's set in South Asia. It's an amazing example of John le Carré's first foray into travel and kind of almost ethnography on the ground. You know, the way he researched that novel was to get deep into the Vietnam War with his friend and the journalist David Greenway. Then we have The Little Drummer Girl, which for the same reasons we chose that because it includes another conflict actually outside of the Cold War, but still within that time frame, so 1983, and kind of Israeli and Palestinian terrorism in Europe. Then we have The Night Manager, which is his first novel published after the Cold War. Then we have The Constant Gardener, Our Kind of Traitor, The Mission Song, and A Most Wanted Man.
Yeah. Yeah, no, really good selection of books, I think. And I'm glad The Constant Gardener was in there because it's obviously my favourite. So
yeah.
So it's good to see. Out of interest, because I know The Honourable Schoolboy is the smiley story that never has been adapted. I don't know if you saw any correspondence about whether there were ever plans to adapt it to the screen, do you know?
I haven't seen any yet. It wouldn't surprise me if there had been a conversation. There probably was, because Le Carré was very keen on adaptations, actually, and what you do find in the archives are kind of enormous boxes full of unfinished plays, unfinished adaptations. For instance, both Our Game and The Mission Song went a very long way into screenplay production before they were finally canned and didn't ever become movies. So he was keen on the adaptation process, and he liked writing for screen. And in fact, you find sometimes the way he wrote his novels was almost like he was writing for screen for the screen. He kind of did scene by scene kind of novel writing. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was there, but I haven't come across it myself.
No, fair enough. So Le Carré was known for meticulous research. So how did he gather information and work with experts from like journalists to whistleblowers to bring authenticity to his novels?
In the beginning, when he was kind of scoping the topics of his novels, he would read anything and everything there was written on that already. Generally, almost always the nonfiction. So he would be reading academics' works, journalists, any published journalism on the topic. And through that, he would then become familiar with the names that were associated with research on those topics. And then you would kind of get a contact from him. Yeah. So he would sort of track you down. And Federico has a great story, which I won't tell, about the way he was tracked down as a young PhD student at the time. So then you would kind of either be contacted from him in that light, but he also employed research assistants. So it wasn't just an ad hoc process. Particularly when his novels were set abroad, like The Constant Gardener, he might hire assistants on the ground. So even though he did travel to those places, he might also have someone there, almost like a fixer. and you know, for one novel, he might have several people doing different bits of research. The Night Manager, you know, he had a journalist, a young journalist at the time, who subsequently became a very well-established author, but she was a security specialist working at the Washington Post, and she did some very in-depth research on the illegal arms trade for him. And at the same time, he was meeting trade regulators in Miami who were giving him sort of under-the-table info about how corrupt officials were managing to smuggle drugs and guns across borders. And, you know, at that time he said, well, if I wanted to buy illegal firearms, he said this to someone in Miami, where would I go? And they said, well, you'd go straight to Panama. So he went straight to Panama. So he kind of, you know, he followed the trail. He followed the scent to an extent. And I'm sure... For his research, definitely some of his training in the intelligence services probably was quite handy.
Yeah, totally. Did you get any insight on how he went about picking topics to write books about?
I think that was very personal to him. Mm. I don't think there was like a one size fits all, but what he did do was he would keep news snippets and articles he'd read, and he would keep, you know, all of his notebooks, all of his notes are kept in the archive, and he would go back to things, you know. And I've read him say in interviews that he would go back to a notebook he'd written 20 years before because he'd met a man on the street in Berlin or somewhere and written a description of them, and then they return in a novel that he writes later on. So he kind of was almost like a magpie picking up all these observations, and they would return one way or another in later fiction. But for instance, when I was doing the research for The Constant Gardener, I don't know this explicitly, but the way he was researching that was first and foremost with an idea that he wanted to write about corporate corruption. So he did not begin that novel knowing that he wanted to write about pharmaceutical corruption and ethics. He actually began researching that novel looking at all sorts of different unethical practices in various developing countries and low-income communities. So looking at like mining disasters in India, for example, various sort of industrial disputes in developing countries and the global south. And then he kind of hit upon the pharmaceutical industry within that, and then he pursued that and then did a huge amount of research on that. He interviewed a couple of whistleblowers who shared their stories with him and went from there. So, yeah.
And he had this famous saying, a desk is a dangerous place to view the world. So how did Le Carré kind of develop this? He had this habit of visiting, obviously, locations that shaped his writing. So what methodology did he use to really get to know a place?
Well, he went there, I suppose, is one of the most important things. He would study the place first. He would, like I said, get all the books. He would get the maps. He would speak to the people, and then he would go there. And while he was there, he would walk the streets. You know, there's lots of people who did these travels with him would talk about how he sort of would just go off into his own head with his little pocketbook, kind of noting things when you don't think there's anything to note, but he'd be noting it down. What I find really fascinating is that his notes are almost like a stream of consciousness. So it would be the sights, the smells, the sounds, the feeling, the heat or the cold. So I suppose that was his immersion was his method, I suppose.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Were there any discoveries in the archive that changed or deepened your understanding of his process?
So for me, his writing process in particular was astounding. So it's quite well known that he wrote a lot of drafts of his novels. And Federico talks about being sent sort of 6 finished versions of Our Game. Wow. But what I find, most interesting is before he'd even finished a novel, his chapters would go through 6 versions before he'd even got to the point where he was sending it to someone like Federico. So you'll find, you know, 5 or 6 different versions of the same chapters. And within that, he was working incredibly closely with his wife, Jane. And they had this kind of dialogue of annotations. So he didn't type anything. She typed it. And his handwritten process was the way in which he really got his thoughts and story on the page. And then he would do that in the morning. And then she would type it up. He would have a break. He would come back to the typed pages and he might cut them up with scissors. He might use sellotape and staples to move them around. Then he would do that. Then he would annotate it, change it, cut it, put little notes on for her. And then she would type it up again. And so in the archive, there is this incredible sort of jigsawing process between the two of them. And it really brings to life both the way that he, as a creative person, had to work. It was the way he had to do it, but also the fact that he relied so heavily on his wife within that. And she wasn't just a typist, you know, she was instrumental to the way that he developed his stories. So I found that just quite astounding.
Yeah, and it's great that the exhibition sort of highlights her role in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. We have some fantastic loans of photography. And she had her own career in publishing. So she didn't just assist in the writing process. She was very important when it came to liaising with agents and publishers and, you know, the final push to have the novel printed. So we hope that we've kind of covered her influence as much as possible.
The exhibition's title, Tradecraft, plays both on espionage skills and his craft as a writer. Mm. How do you see that dual meaning reflected in his work?
I'm sure he said this himself before, but the way that he used, I think, some of those tricks of the trade, the intelligence skills, the kind of interrogation, the following the scent, sort of following the trail, hiding in plain sight to do his research, yeah. Playing different parts. You know, he was famously excellent at impersonation, but I think he shapeshifted a lot when he was doing his research. I think that, you know, his own personal tradecraft actually sort of kind of seeped into the way that he researched his novels as well. So, and then obviously, so we have, on one hand, we have the tradecraft to mean the tradecraft he used to do the research. But then on the other hand, he completely changed the course of espionage fiction in the English language. And what we do pick up on in the exhibition is the fact that he created this entire kind of George Smiley universe and tradecraft vocabulary that in itself has come to influence so many other writers and so many other creatives in fictionalizing that intelligence world.
And the real world too.
Yes, yeah. So we wanted to have that double entendre to really pick up on that.
Yeah. Let's take a break and be right back with more. So Le Carré described himself as a writer who once worked as a spy rather than a spy who became a writer. How do you think that distinction influenced his creative voice?
It's quite funny, actually. I think he got quite fed up of being positioned as a spy who became a spy writer, someone who just drew on their own experiences. I think it annoyed him because he first and foremost felt himself as a creative and an artist. And so it was frustrating that I think for him, the idea that he had been a spy and then a writer kind of diminished and undermined his actual creativity. And we do have an item in the exhibition that you'll have seen where it's a handwritten note that he's written about. He's basically really peeved that he's still being called, you know, a spy writer. And he says, no one would say this if no one would call me a cowboy who writes about cowboys, you know, or that such and such.
Because spy fiction was sort of looked down upon as well, traditionally, in some ways. So, yeah.
Although, I mean, with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, he absolutely smashed that out of the water. So, you know, he knew, although he struggled after the success of that novel to kind of pick up his career again, he knew that he was doing something different. And the thing is, and we make this very clear in the exhibition as well, he was an artist before he was a writer.
Yeah.
So he illustrated for a long time before he even began writing novels. He was an excellent caricature artist, cartoonist, and he'd already been illustrating published books and journals. So I think at heart, he felt himself to be someone with this kind of creative impetus and someone who wanted to create art. So I think it did frustrate him. And I think also, you know, on the other hand, he obviously had been a spy. He did work in both intelligence services. He's not really allowed to speak about it, or at least until recently, he wasn't really allowed to speak about it. And so I think he just was annoyed that people kept asking him.
Yes, like, fair enough. One thing I didn't know until the exhibition, I don't know if it was me being silly, but I didn't realise he was an illustrator in his spare time. How did his sketches and watercolours kind of feed into the written work and character building?
Yeah, so definitely in the early stages of creating his characters, he did a lot of doodles. So there's a lot of doodling in the archive. It's not always clear which characters they relate to, but it's obviously part of his, you know, I think he had a very visual mind. So, and this also goes with the fact that he traveled a lot. I think he needed to see things before he wrote them down and before he translated them into words. So I think his doodling really helped him visualize the people and sometimes the places within his novels. And it's just fantastic to see, you know, these early handwritten descriptions kind of built up around a doodle. It really brings to life how he was kind of imagining these worlds that he was creating.
Yeah, fantastic. And there's some great, obviously, examples in the exhibition, which are brilliant. So
yeah.
His later novels obviously became more outspoken and political. So how do you see his political evolution reflected in the sort of manuscripts and correspondence?
Yes, I'm still divided about why he became more outspoken towards the end of his life. I suppose the obvious answer would be that there was more to be outspoken about. The watershed really was the Iraq War. That seems to have been the line in the sand. And that's when he used his platform and his privilege as a very well-known author who, until that point, hadn't really dabbled in public life in that sense. With the Iraq War, he went on several anti-Iraq marches. He wrote a very, very angry kind of think piece in the Times against it. And then from that moment on, he became more vocal. So around the time that The Constant Gardener was published, you know, with the PR for The Constant Gardener, he was very vocal about the dangers of pharmaceutical companies having too much power and the international law surrounding pharmaceutical patents. So he gradually introduced some of those politics into his novels gradually. And A Most Wanted Man is another example, because that deals with the era of rendition and illegal detention and Guantanamo Bay and, you know, torture of men who hadn't been tried legally. So kind of the kind of catastrophic reduction of their human rights. So I think he slowly embedded some of those political ideas into his novels, but then in his public life he was becoming more and more vocal. And then with Brexit, it happened again, and he was on the anti-Brexit marches. And then with Trump's first election, the same thing. In 2016, he continued to talk about his horror at the erosion of social democracy and legal elections and, you know, the concerns around disinformation. He was criticised for some of his later novels, for the way that his politics seeped into his story writing. I don't think it was necessarily... I don't think it was conscious. I think it was an organic extension of the way he was feeling about the world.
Yeah, but at the same time, a lot of people level these criticisms at anything ever so slightly political. When you look at a lot of writing from the past, I mean, like, people claim Star Trek suddenly gone woke, just taking it away from Lacaille for a moment. But Star Trek's always been technically woke because it's the show that had the first interracial kiss on television. So, So I think, I mean, I noticed in Lacaille's early books, he had a suspicion of American power. So in The Perfect Spy, there's elements of that, certainly in other novels too. And I think that with the Iraq War, I can totally understand why that was a big line in the sand for him, because it's a big abuse of power, basically.
Yes, 100%. And and it's really interesting the way he talked about the Cold War, because, I mean, another thing that's very much been on my mind recently is Le Carré's, the way Le Carré spoke about patriotism versus nationalism. And he was often criticized for criticizing England. He was, you know, we actually have an example of that in the exhibition. But he always talked about himself as a patriot, and he always talked about himself as loving his country as well as loving Europe. And the way he talked about his own actions in MI5 and MI6 in the early Cold War, to him, I think, remained justified in the context of the dangers of communism in that early period. And he was able to interrogate that, and he was able to see that actually those dangers perhaps weren't as awful as they were feared. But in the context of being a young man at that time, he still was able to justify his role within it. But then above that, he was also able to stand back and look at the macro kind of history of these periods and say, you know, and this is why his Cold War work is so fascinating and brilliant, is it was ambiguous. By the end of the Cold War, there wasn't really an enemy. There wasn't really a winner. There were no victors. And so, yeah, until the very end, he had an interesting take on kind of fighting for your country versus standing back and being able to take criticism, and being able to be wrong.
Yeah, there's so many contemporary issues I'd love to have his perspective on, because obviously we've just had this sort of flag campaign over the summer. We've obviously got the Israel-Palestine conflict that's been really terrible since October the 7th. We've had the rise of Trump again. I mean, there's so many things I'm sure he would have given us a lot of perspective on.
Me too. And actually, that was something that I couldn't stop thinking about while I was researching and curating this exhibition. And it's part of the reason, because we do include audio in the exhibition, we have a listening station. And with the listening station, we've used interviews from across the course of his career to kind of pick up on some of the things that were most important to him. And they included things like social democracy, too much power in the hands of corporate kind of corporate demigods. And I think having his voice in the exhibition talking about that those things actually brings to light how contemporary his themes are, and particularly the flags recently. I would genuinely have loved to know what he would have said about that, because he often commented on the difference between patriotism and nationalism And I think he would have been quite a revered figure to speak out on that. And also, of course, he was very worried about the extension of the kind of intelligence state in the post-Cold War period and surveillance. He had a lot to say about the misuse of intelligence in this day and age and its connection with disinformation. And that would have been really interesting as well to hear his thoughts on that.
Yeah, and even the war in Ukraine as well. My goodness, I missed out on my list of things. Social media and disinformation. Oh my goodness, the list never ends. I mean, it just makes you realize what we've lost with his passing, really. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. Are there any books of his that you have a personal connection with, either as a reader or a collaborator?
So my favourite novel, I suppose, put it that way, is A Perfect Spy. I think because I spent so much time in the archives thinking about him as a writer and how his life had influenced his writing, I find the sort of tension between reality and fiction in that novel really intriguing, because I still can't pinpoint. I mean, there's some obvious things in there that he definitely drew on his real life to depict. But there's still some things where I'm like, oh, was that from real life or is that made up? And I think it kind of, it was also a novel that he was incredibly proud of. He was really pleased to have finally written something in which he could include the character of his father without sounding kind of self-indulgent and self-pitying. Yeah. And it's also beautifully written and it's very, very accomplished. That would definitely be my kind of standout novel.
Yeah, excellent choice. For someone new to Le Carré, which novel would you recommend maybe as an entry point, especially in light of the exhibition?
So I suppose I have to say Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but actually, and we do talk about The Spy Who Came In from the Cold in the exhibition, although it isn't one of our novels. I think I would probably start with The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, because particularly as a Cold War historian, I'm still fixated on how the Berlin Wall was constructed and how it emerged from this standoff between the West and the East. And then overnight, pretty much, it was constructed. And I think that novel is just, it's just an incredible encapsulation of a moment in time when it really wasn't clear what would happen. You know, where was this going? So I think for anyone entering Le Carré from the beginning, it would have to be that one.
Yeah, fantastic. Another good choice there. And what do you hope visitors will take away from Tradecraft about Le Carré, not just a writer, but as a thinker and observer of the modern world?
Yeah, so some of the conversations we've just been having about like the themes that transcend his entire career as a writer, I hope people are left wondering like, gosh, what does this mean for now? You know, like, you know, if Le Carré were to write about our present day and our society and the world, how would he be feeling about it? What kinds of themes would he be picking up on? I also hope people come away wanting to reread his books or read his books, go and find other novels that aren't in the exhibition, because there are lots, obviously, and just really explore his writing again. I really also hope that lots of people visit this exhibition who don't know Le Carré at all and who might, you know, just have their interest piqued and want to find out more. So, yeah.
Was there a particular standout item for you in the exhibition that you particularly loved?
Yeah. So I'll give you two examples because, they're quite different. So within our loans that we have from the family, one of the things we loaned is the suitcase of his mother's. His mother left Le Carré and his older brother when they were 5 and 7 years old. She couldn't bear really to live with their father anymore, Ronnie Cornwall, who was abusive and a very unpleasant man. And she left. And that abandonment was hugely influential in Le Carré's life, and he's talked about it a lot since, especially in his memoir, The Pigeon Tunnel. And in The Pigeon Tunnel, he talks about finding her and reconnecting with her, which I think was a very strange experience for him. And she only had two objects left from that time in her life. One of them was a photograph and one of them was this suitcase. And it has her married initials on it. So there's nothing else with her name from her Cornwall era. And we have that suitcase in the exhibition, which I think is an incredibly poignant reminder of his childhood and kind of some of the personal influences that kind of he carried with him throughout his life. Yeah. And the other one would probably be, so I talked about the way that he wrote page after page of these chapters. And we have a very early description of George Smiley from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So George Smiley enters Tinker Tailor in chapter two. So we have an early draft of the first page of chapter two, and George Smiley is walking through these damp, rainy London streets. And Le Carré is working on this description of his girth and his sort of, and his kind of very unathletic gait. And it's just a great, example of his writing process.
Yeah, I particularly like seeing the painted stone with "fix it" written.
Yes.
That did make me chuckle when I saw that.
Yeah, and he'd made that stone, yeah. So he put that on top of drafts that weren't ready. You know, he needed to fix them. Yeah, I mean, there's loads of gold in the exhibition. Yeah,
excellent. For the benefit of my co-host Matt, do you know what brand of pen John Le Carré used? Because I filmed the pen, and it's his black pen, but I couldn't work out who made it.
I do. I think it's a Schaefer.
A Schaefer, okay.
So I think, but I believe he used a different pen to write his drafts, and he used a Parker fountain pen to do his signature. So his signatures were in a fountain pen, but it was a Schaefer ballpoint pen. And yes, we have one on display, still with the sellotape that he's used to fix it. So it's wrapped in sellotape to fix the nib.
Fantastic. Oh yeah, it makes a lot of sense using the fountain pen for your signature, because they always look better with fountain pen signatures.
Yeah. Definitely.
Well, lastly then, there's this fantastic book, Tradecraft Rises on John Le Carré, and so it's a companion to the exhibition. So how does it kind of complement and expand on the exhibition experience?
Yes, so Federico drew together a range of writers who aren't literary experts, but one way or another had a creative connection with Le Carré. So they aren't, they're also not Le Carré experts. They've never written about John Le Carré before. But in this book, they draw on the themes of the exhibition. John Le Carré is a writer-researcher, someone who was very much a globalist and positioned his work in the context of kind of geopolitics and international relations, and someone who was very keen also on kind of adaptations. So we have the director of one of his adaptations in the book, and all of them write from the perspective of people looking at his process differently and the impact of his work differently from alternative perspectives. And one of the chapters is written, for example, by the journalist Michaela Wrong, who's also in the exhibition, who took Le Carré to Rwanda and Eastern Congo when he was researching the Mission Song. And some of the things I've talked about here about the way he observed the details of the places he visited, she really illustrates and kind of evokes that brilliantly in her chapter in the book. And Federico also talking about their relationship as collaborators and friends. So it's a real insight into kind of, the way he worked.
Yeah. Jessica, thank you so much for joining me, Steve. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you, and where can they also find out more about the exhibition?
Okay, so if you go to the Bodleian Library's social media or webpage, you can find out all about the exhibition. We're running a lecture series, so there will be one lecture every month for the time that the exhibition is on, with various experts. To find out more about me, I actually am not on social media at the moment because...
Don't blame you.
Yeah, for reasons that are probably quite obvious, I can't bear it. So I'm on LinkedIn.
Yep, cool. That's a good place to be, actually.
And you can Google me for all of my publications and anything I've done previous to this. So, yeah.
Cool. So people want to connect, LinkedIn's the best place.
Yeah. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And it's been nice to sort of catch up again.
Yeah, it's been great to speak. Yeah.
Thank you.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.